This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Liv and Lynn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. The Malaysia Agreement is the legal instrument signed in 1963, which led to the formation of the Federation of Malaysia. On this episode of Law and Behold, we're going to do a quick refresher course on this fascinating document, which was drawn up after a lengthy process of bargaining and negotiations involving the Federation of Malaya, the UK government, North Borneo, Sabah, Sarawak and Singapore. And we're also going to discuss the supposed breaches of the treaty and why there are so many calls to review the agreement with Emeritus Professor Dr. Shad Salim Farooqi, a Professor of Law at the University of Malaya, and Brendan Keith So, the Attorney General of Sabah. Welcome, gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Thank you, Juliet. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be with Brendan here.
Thank you. Likewise, I'd like to express my gratitude for being invited to this interview at this platform. And I'm likewise honoured to share airtime with Professor Shad on this topic, which is close to my heart, as it is for a majority, if not all, Sabahans, as well as our neighbours, Sarawak.
Mm-hmm. And thank you so much for joining us. You know, we really appreciate you making the time. So just to get, you know, right into it, can we begin with a quick refresher course on MA63 or the Malaysia Agreement 1963 and the circumstances that led to its signing? Prof, would you like to start?
Well, it's a very long story, of course, but I think the seeds of Malaysia were in the post-war decolonization process. Britain was trying to disengage itself from its colonies and protected territories, and it is the British who began negotiation with Malaya, Sabah, Sarawak, Singapore, and even Brunei, seeking to form a greater federation. In 1962, a lot of events, Malaysia Solidarity Consultative Committee Resolution, Legislative Council of North Borneo, which was Sabah, 20-point manifesto of Sabah Alliance, 18-point agreement of Sarawak. I don't know why it's called agreement. It's also a manifesto. Then the Cobalt Commission. It's given a lot of importance, but when I look at it, actually, the Cobalt Commission was basically between the British and the Malayan government. It did not involve the people of North Borneo or Sarawak. Mm. It's the later IGC, Intergovernmental Committee, that actually had a necessary representation from the regions that were going to hopefully come together. So there was the IGC 1962, where Tun Razak was one of the members. Then general election took place in North Borneo, December 62. In Sarawak in 1963. But as we all know, Philippines and Indonesia objected to this proposed union. Mm-hmm. And so the British government arranged for a tripartite summit in Manila in 63. And that didn't lead to much agreement. So there was a UN Secretary General's mission that spent 3 weeks in Sabah, Sarawak. I know that many of my friends and colleagues say that this mission was not really properly done. It didn't really interview enough people. Its views were very, very superficial. Indeed, they may have been. But nevertheless, there was this UN Secretary General's mission. But even before the mission submitted its report on 15 September, the Malaysia Agreement was signed on July 9, 1963. I understand that actually August 31 was supposed to be the day for Malaysia Day, same day as Merdeka. But then because of political delays, the agreement could not be, Malaysia could not be formed on that day. Then on 20th August 63, the Malaysia Act number 26 of 1963 was passed. And to me, actually, I know that you mentioned Malaysia Agreement. Actually, whether the Malaysia Agreement, the Cobalt Commission, the IGC have legal effect is a matter of great dispute. Mm-hmm. I personally think the concept of law must be understood, interpreted holistically. I am a great admirer of Ronald Dworkin, who believes that law consists of rules as well as non-rule standards, by which he means principles of justice, morality, and I'm sure he would also agree international treaties. But I have to alert you and all your listeners that in Malaysia, under Article 160, Clause 2, the word law is defined. And the word law includes on the written law, common law, a and custom to the extent recognized. International law, international treaties, agreements, manifestos, and Cobalt Commission report, IJC report, strictly speaking, they may be regarded by many judges as not law properly so-called. Mm-hmm. I personally adopt, that's my personal view, a broader view. But nevertheless, I just want to alert you that while it's nice to look at all these historical documents and agreements and treaties, I think the beginning point would be the Malaysia Act, 1963. It had 96 clauses, and this is what resulted in amendments to the Federal Constitution of the Federation of Malaya. The numbers are slightly in variance. My counting says that out of 181 articles at that time, mm-hmm. 87 were amended. So that's nearly, that's more than one-third, isn't it?
Yeah.
10 out of 13 schedules of the Constitution were amended. 35 new articles were added, 11 were removed. And all in all, the effect was this, that Sabah, Sarawak, Singapore joined Malaya to form the new nation of Malaysia, much, much larger, much more diverse. And the rights of Sabah, Sarawak were very special. Sabah, Sarawak, Singapore, what we would call in constitutional law, this was an asymmetrical federation. In other words, the theory is that all units must be equal. But here, Sabah, Sarawak, Singapore would not have come in had they not been given special treatment. So I think a new nation was born, but this new nation, this new federation, was a federation in which Sabah, Sarawak, Singapore were separate units, and they had special autonomy and guarantees of their diversity and of their values and vulnerabilities. It hasn't worked that way entirely, but I think that was the aim, that this was not going to be simply a situation where Sabah, Sarawak, Singapore would be on par with Perlis and Malacca.
Brendan, is there anything you'd like to add to that?
Yes, I think it is important from a historical perspective to know how and why Malaysia was formed with the inclusion of then Singapore, Sabah and Sarawak. We must take note that this whole process or this whole negotiation took place just over a little 2 years.
Oh, yes.
Which is, one may say, is a very short period of time within which to form and create a larger nation. I think one of the things that is important to highlight to the listeners is that the Cobalt Commission report had these findings when they held 50 hearings at 35 different centres, and they heard oral representations from about 690 groups mm-hmm. comprising of 4,000 people in order to assess the likelihood or the feasibility of forming Malaysia with Sabah, Sarawak and Singapore. The commission actually found this, and it wasn't a across-the-board decision from the representatives that they met. What the commission found was this. One-third of the population in Sabah and Sarawak strongly favoured a formation without conditions. Another one-third favoured Malaysia with varying conditions and protection. And the remaining one-third were divided between those insisting on independence before
yes, Malaysia, yes.
and those who preferred British rule. There was also a hardcore 20% in the last group who actually opposed Malaysia in totality. Nevertheless, the recommendations of the Cobalt Commission clearly indicated that a new federation of Malaysia would be in the best interests of the people of the Borneo States, subject to certain safeguards to protect yeah. these interests of the North Borneo people and Sarawak. Moving forward, the rationale why these safeguards were necessary were that it was recognized that Sabah and Sarawak were clearly distinct in both culture and religious beliefs. Sabah and Sarawak also contributed a large area of land, a total amount of 198,000 square kilometers mm-hmm. to Malaysia, whereas Peninsular Malaysia is only 131,000 square kilometers. There were issues with underdevelopment and poverty in the Borneo States, and these rights and provisions were a precondition to forming Malaysia, as evidenced by the earlier 20 points. And it was because of that that there was a recognition that financial provisions needed to be addressed for North Borneo and Sarawak. And in fact, it's been recorded that there was a deadlock on these financial issues, but these were overcome by recognizing in our federal constitution certain additional revenue rights and special grants for the Borneo states. Clearly at that time, Sabah and Sarawak recognized that they had vast natural resources and the potential to develop those for the benefit of Malaysia as a whole means that there needed to be some recognition for that contribution.
Okay, all right. And, you know, both of you have mentioned this, that, you know, Sabah and Sarawak joined Malaya to form Malaysia with the understanding that there will be guarantees within the federal constitution to protect their rights and privileges. And, you know, and that these guarantees and safeguards have since been inserted into the constitution and relevant laws. What do some of these privileges include?
Well, very large number. Actually, this is a whole area. I would have to invite you to join our constitutional law class, Juliet. Well, first of all, much broader lawmaking powers. As we all know, we are a federal system. The Constitution divides legislative power between the federal government and the states. But for Sabah, Sarawak and Singapore, there was a special supplementary legislative list. So, for example, native law, ports and harbors, shipping under 15 tons, charities, they were in the supplementary state list. There's an additional supplementary concurrent list. Also, in some areas, the federal government is able to bulldoze its way through. For example, on matter of land, agriculture, forestry, local government. Though these topics are in the state list, state hands, federal government can impose uniform policies. But Article 95D says that no, in matter of land, agriculture, forestry, local government, Sabah Sarawak is not subject to the power of the federal government to pass uniform laws. Constitutional amendments, a little bit embarrassed to report to you that normally in countries, amendments are made with the consent of everyone, especially in federal systems. In our country, we are unique that a constitutional amendment can be made without the consent of the states of the federation. Mm-hmm. The only exception is Sabah, Sarawak, and Article 161, capital E. And possibly one more, if that's Article 2, brackets B, if you want to take away the territory of Selangor to constitute Wilayah Persekutuan, or then you have to get the consent of the Selangor Assembly. But the amazing thing is that amendments can be made in this country without getting the consent. And the best example of that was when Sabah, Sarawak, Singapore were to join. Kelantan objected and said, "You haven't got our consent." And Chief Justice Thompson, who heard the case, said, "The law doesn't require." So maybe your views may be proven right in the decades ahead, but legally, you have no case. So constitutional amendments require consent of Sabah Sarawak. Native courts are allowed. There is a high court for Sabah Sarawak. And I'm just saying this partly in a lighthearted way. Lawyers from West Malaysia are not allowed to practice in Sabah Sarawak. But Sabah Sarawak lawyers are allowed to practice in West Malaysia. I suppose the idea was that Sabah Sarawakians must be given protection from being flooded with the more, at that time, the more developed West Malaysian legal profession. There is a chief judge of Sabah Sarawak. In his appointment, there must be a consultation with the chief minister. Judicial commissioners must be appointed by the Yang di Pertua Negeri on the advice of the chief justice. That's Article 122AB. And I'm sorry to report that protection was taken away. So now, judicial commissioner is appointed by the Yang di Pertua Negeri on the advice of the chief justice. The representation in the Dewan Rakyat for Sabah Sarawak Singapore was 35%. Now it is down to 25.2%. Mm-hmm. The importance of that is this, that if they have 33 or more percent, then amendments cannot be passed without their consent. Sadly, with the expulsion or withdrawal of Singapore, Sabah Sarawak's representation in the Dewan Rakyat now is 56 out of 222, which is only 25.2%. Under Article 150 emergency, even if there is emergency declared, native law and custom in Sabah Sarawak cannot be violated. Development plans of the National Land Council, National Council for Local Government are not applicable to Sabah Sarawak. Special position of the Malays equally applies to the natives of Sabah Sarawak. Equally, Article 153 actually uses Malays and the natives of Sabah Sarawak together. Though I know there's very strong complaint that Article 153 for Sabah-Sarawak has not been taken seriously. Immigration controls are there. So if, Juliet, you and I want to go there, well, it's not so easy. non-resident lawyers cannot practice. English and native languages, there's special protection. Many people may not know that actually Sarawak has not agreed to the National Language Act.
Yes, that's right,
yeah,
yes.
Malay reserves are not applicable in Sabah-Sarawak. I'll just mention two or three points very quickly. Just one more, actually. Fiscal federalism, though perhaps on that, Brendan has already informed us. This was a very special matter, and it was quite controversial. But rightly so, because money represents power. Money makes the government work. And therefore, some special resources of sources of revenue were allocated. Taxes and fees from ports and harbors, sales tax. I know between Petronas and Sarawak there is this problem, but sales tax is actually in Sabah Sarawak, and there are special grants. In the 10th schedule, part 4, item 2, there's an incredible provision, and you know, I've read it at least about 20 times, and I have to confess to all my law students, I don't understand it. But Brandon could help me, but The gist seems to be this. 10th schedule item 2, 10th schedule part 4. 40% of the net revenue derived from Sarawak must be returned to the state minus amounts received by the state. So 40% of whatever is earned from Sabah Sarawak. Now, how we calculate what is earned, I do not know, because I just want to say this, and Brendan could assist me. Lot of things which are actually in state hands, are in state jurisdiction, mm-hmm. are the source of income, but the federal government takes that money. Let me give an example. Land is in state hands. So I have a piece of property in Sabah, somewhere in Sabah. I sell it to you. The property gains tax doesn't go to Sabah. It comes to the federal government. The stamp duty on transactions. Transaction involving land, involving property, which is a state matter. The stamp duty goes to the federal government. So actually, how we calculate revenue derived from Sabah, revenue derived from Sarawak, is something on which I'm really not capable of expressing an opinion. So I totally agree with Brendan that the ironclad demand from Sabah, Sarawak, Singapore was that if this new nation is to be born, there must be some special autonomy given to these regions.
Brendan, maybe you can help Prof, you know, with those issues that were a bit difficult for him and difficult for me as well, I do admit.
Certainly. Let me home in on this paragraph 2.1 of part 4 of the 10th schedule, which was essentially it's a revenue sharing arrangement. So for Sabah, the result was that this had been recommended in the IGC, the MA63, and actually incorporated in the federal constitution.
Yes.
What it states is that Sabah's net revenue entitlement is that all federal revenue derived from Sabah, which would include the taxation, income tax that they derive from Sabah, less the assignments of that revenue back to the state in the form of perhaps grants, that balance amount times 2/5 would be the special grant to be given annually to the state. That's where the 40% comes from. Now, how one calculates this figure, I think even in 1970, they had difficulties calculating this figure. And so they decided to actually make an order that the figure be fixed at 26.7 million. And this was pursuant to a review in 1970. And subsequently, this figure of 26.7 million has remained since 1973 until as recently as last year. It is a review that is mandatory every 5 years under Article 112D of the Federal Constitution. So there's definitely a strong case to assert that there had been a breach on the part of the federal government in both perhaps quantum and the requirement for a review. However, there are provisos within the constitution that do state that such grant is based on the financial position of the federal government and the needs of Sabah so as to meet the cost of these state services. What had happened as recently as last year under the previous federal government was this, and this was announced during the State Legislative Assembly sitting in March. It was announced that the federal government have agreed to review this amount and increase it doubly from 26.7 million to 53.4 million for the years 2022 until 2023. It then jumped to 80 million for 2024, and then finally to 106.8 million. This replaces the previous special grant order that I mentioned had been fixed since 1973. As I understand it, the state have accepted this revision, but without prejudice, and in fact have submitted an appeal then requesting for the basis or the formula for coming to this figure. It's all well and good that the original figure since 1970 has been increased double and by 2024 almost fourfold, but until one knows exactly what revenue was derived by the federal government, one wouldn't really know whether that is an accurate or adequate figure. So this is still something which I think the state needs to pursue, because in the interest of transparency and accountability, one would need to know whether this figure is in accordance with the revenue sharing arrangement that is agreed to between the state and the federal government. So that's still very much a live issue. The other thing that I would like to touch on, which was mentioned by Professor Shard, is the right to practice before the court. Clearly, that was a constitutional safeguard incorporated under Article 161B. And the reason for that is that there was already a legal fraternity, if you like. There was already a legislation for the legal practice pre-Malaysia. That was called the Advocates Ordinance. Sabah and Sarawak both have one. And when Malaysia was formed, the right to practice before the courts became a federal law. So the state law was declared federal, and therefore any amendments to the state law must go through Parliament, not through the Legislative Assembly in the state. However, what Article 161B states is this: any removal of the protection or the right to practice before the courts in Sabah, before it can be removed by Parliament, but before it can be brought into force, it needs a separate enactment from the State Legislative Assembly to approve that removal of that protection. The protection is this, that you must have a Sabah connection in order to practice before the courts. Either you were born in Sabah, or you have been residing in Sabah for 5 years, or you have the intention to be domiciled. So these preconditions were pre-Malaysia, and the safeguards that have been recognized in the federal constitution are that Parliament may remove these safeguards, but it can only come into force if the state agree to it in their state assembly by the passing of an enactment. And I'd just like to share with you that recently the Advocates Ordinance had been amended in 2017. It was amended by Parliament, and before doing so, this was a government-backed bill, before doing so they had actually consulted the state. And I think this is where I would like to highlight, it is important that notwithstanding that Parliament may amend laws affecting the state, which do not touch on removal of any of the protections that are afforded to the state, they did consult the state government. And I think this is where something which should be enhanced, the communication between the state and the federal governments, that essentially there should be a consultation process, there needs to be stakeholder engagement. And I think that would go a long way to improving the relationships between the state and federal government, as indicated with the amendment to our Advocates Ordinance, so much so that it was passed smoothly and there were no issues regarding any sort of fear that perhaps Parliament was amending something that would affect the state without its knowledge.
Okay. All right. I'm speaking today to Emeritus Professor Dr. Shad Salim Farooqi, who is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Malaya, and Brendan Keith So, who is the Attorney General of Sabah. And we're kind of going through the Malaysia Agreement 1963, finding out what's been implemented and what's not been implemented. And we're going to continue that discussion after this quick break. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. It is time for Law and Behold. And today on the show, we are speaking to Emeritus Professor Dr. Shad Salim Farooqi, a professor of constitutional law at the University of Malaya, and Brendan Keith So, who is the Attorney General of Sabah. And we are discussing the Malaysia Agreement 1963. So, before the break, we went through quite in depth, with what the whole agreement was about. And Prof, you wrote in an article recently that in many areas, Sabah and Sarawak's autonomy has suffered serious retreat. Could you elaborate on that for me?
Well, yes, Juliet, I plead guilty as charged.
I follow you, Prof. I know yes. What you're saying.
Yeah, well, in many areas, there have been regrettable constitutional amendments which have resulted in retreat of the autonomy. For example, when Malaysia began its Tryst with Destiny, Article 1, Clause 2 symbolically mentioned the states of Malaya in one clause, Sabah Sarawak in another clause, Singapore in the third clause. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe this doesn't have clear-cut legal effect, but the symbolic part was that these are distinct regions. Article 1, Clause 2 was amended. Now, actually, all the states, all the 13 states are in one continuous paragraph alphabetically. Now, I just do not know whether this amendment was submitted to the Yang di Pertuan Negeri of Sabah Sarawak for his consent, because as we mentioned earlier, any amendment affecting the rights of Sabah Sarawak must go to the Yang di Pertuan Negeri Sabah Sarawak. So I don't know whether Article 1 Clause 2 is a constitutionally valid amendment. Labuan became a federal territory.
That's right.
I think that's a sore point with many people. This is a little bit controversial, but I have to say it politely. In the matter of Islam, in 1963, there was no state religion either in Sabah or in Sarawak. Mm-hmm. In fact, there was an Article 161C and an Article 161D. And this Article 161C was repealed in 1976. Basically, what it said is this, that if you use taxpayers' money to promote Islamic institution, then Islamic education, then an equivalent amount must be used for social welfare in Sabah Sarawak. And this law to promote aid for Islamic institutions must be consented to by the governor. And then Article 161D said, again it was repealed in 1976, that in West Malaysia, Article 11 Clause 4 permits the state governments of West Malaysia to prohibit or to regulate the teaching of any religion to Muslims, any religion. In other words, proselytization of Muslims can be regulated or banned. This law did not apply in Sabah Sarawak in 1963. The law banning propagation requires a two-thirds majority. So that means it is almost like amendment procedure to the Constitution. Both these provisions were taken away. There has been federalization of critical state matters such as water and tourism. One of the greatest rights that Sabah Sarawak had was control over immigration. But sadly, though immigration is a Sabah Sarawak matter, citizenship, naturalization is a federal matter. And I think that's what the federal government did. And there's no point in denying the presence of this elephant in our sitting room. This happened.
Yeah.
Millions of people, I'm told 25% of the population of Sabah, not having the right statistics, are basically illegal immigrants who had been naturalized. So these are some of the areas where legal changes took place. But in other matters, administratively, things didn't quite work out well. For example, Article 153's special position treatment mm-hmm. has not been vigorously enforced. I just read this and I was shocked to read that there are seats available in the medical hospitals. There are local people available. And yet actually, the seats are kept vacant for doctors. I'm told that in Sarawak, there is one doctor for 892 people. In the Klang Valley, there's one doctor for 150 people. So in this respect, social and health facilities, the Borneonization, if I may put it that way, of the administrative services has not taken place. Economic development over 57 years has been very slow. Native law and native courts have had to give way to Islam and Sharia courts. Even for the natives of Sabah, Sarawak, who are Muslims, the law says that native law will not apply. And I notice this, that in the matter of power to punish, the power of the native courts is lesser than the power of the Sharia courts. So deliberately then the native courts have been put on a pedestal lower than the Sharia courts. Representation in parliament, we mentioned, from 35%, it is now down to 25%. On the matter of language and religion, there has been a lot of change. Sabah, by its own amendment, and that's something I have to point out, the amendment was not made by the federal parliament, but by the Sabah assembly itself. They have adopted Islam as the religion of the federation. They adopted Bahasa Melayu as their official language. Sarawak has stayed firm, but on the matter of language and religion, massive changes have taken place. And finally, in the matter of finances, there's a lot of discontent about oil and oil fields, that agreement between Sabah, Sarawak and Petronas. And I'm told, not just for Sabah, Sarawak, I'm told that the overall revenue in our federation is very lopsided. We don't have fiscal federalism. I'm told that for every one ringgit that the federal government earns from all sorts of taxes and all, the states combined earn 10 sen. So there is only 10% of the total revenue. So obviously these are things that ultimately will cause a great deal of discontent. There is discontent about territorial waters, but that's quite complicated. Maybe Brendan could help us on that. There is a lot of improper interference in the politics of Sabah, Sarawak. Emergency was declared in 1966 to get rid of Kalong Nyingkan. The federal maneuvering, there was a lot of federal maneuvering to cause the downfall of Pyrin's PBS twice in Sabah in the 80s and 90s and again into 2020. There are allegations that actually federal government is behind the forced by election. Then there was forced rotation of MBs in Sarawak. Was it Sarawak or Sabah? The force, the Menteri Besar will be 2 years and 2 years and they'll come on.
Sabah.
Sabah, yeah. So now UMNO's entry into Sabah, setting up a Berjaya to topple Mustafa's Usno, diluting of power of the natives by clever naturalization of illegal immigrants. So these are real issues. History books. The history of Malaysia is the history of Malaya. Sabah Sarawak is conveniently ignored. There is all this talk about the Islamic State, forgetting that Sabah Sarawak, Sarawak does not even have Islam as the religion of the state. It, of course, accepts Article 3 as the federal provision. The Hudud Law Act 55, the Kalima Allah issue, Bibles in Bahasa Melayu, the exporting of identity politics of the peninsula in regions which are multicultural, which have a moderate ethos. Small, I don't know whether these are small, but these are things that hurt. August 31 was celebrated, but not September 16, till about 10 years ago.
That's right, yeah.
And even today, September 16 is celebrated only in the States. It is not celebrated in Kuala Lumpur, but that's the day when Malaysia was born. So actually there is a great deal of discontent. But giving this long list, I have to quickly add, I want to say this to all students of constitutional law, that actually tensions are inherent in any federal system, whether it is India, Assam, Kashmir, Sudan, North, South, Biafra, Nigeria, even in Canada, Quebec, the United States president is having problems over the COVID-19 control policies with the states. So I think tensions are inherent in a federal system. And you see, what was happening was this, Juliet, that because of the steamroller majority that the Barisan Nasional had, these tensions were always swept under the carpet. But now, as politics is becoming more competitive and democracy and free speech are taking roots, slowly, but they are taking roots, we are witnessing the open airing of grievances. So this is not entirely a bad development. I'm optimistic that actually it shows an emerging democracy. And as long as more people talk about it, the first thing to solve a problem is to find out what the problem is.
To acknowledge that there are problems as well.
And I think, as Brendan pointed out, there is some conversation and dialogue taking place.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I mean, Brendan, maybe you can help us. You know, are we seeing move towards reviewing these sorts of federal and state relations?
Certainly. I suppose last year was an indication that the bill to amend the federal constitution, as Professor Shard has mentioned, to restore the original wording of Article 1 in relation to where the definition of Malaysia, to restore it to the separated A, B, and C, which was the states of Malaya and the Borneo states. Of course, the state of Singapore has been removed, just to indicate that the original format, at least from an optics point of view, would put matters in perspective when one defines the federation. And it would also provide a platform to reinforce the fact that Sabah and Sarawak are not like the other 11 states in the peninsula. They are states with additional powers, sources of revenue which need to be implemented. And if one looks back at the historical chronology, it's very clear that the Cobbold Commission recommended that Malaysia should be an association of partners. And the then Deputy Prime Minister Tun Abdul Razak at the time was recorded as saying, "We are bringing the other territories into Malaysia as equal partners." So I think from the optics perspective, restoring the definition of the federation to what it was before would only seek to reinforce the hopes and the aspirations of the Borneo states then in the creation of a new federation. Unfortunately, that didn't succeed as the requisite two-thirds majority was not achieved in Parliament. I agree that it would not have changed anything in substance as far as the federal constitution is concerned. It would have been the first step, perhaps, to creating awareness, putting back of what the original wording was, and giving that platform, which I think the Borneo states have for some time now longed for in order to restore what had originally been agreed. Moving now on to where we are now, I think it could be useful to record what happened over the past year or so in relation to a special cabinet committee that was formed to restore the rights as agreed to in the Malaysia Agreement 1963. And there was a list of 21 issues. Now, this list of 21 issues did not all necessarily relate to MA63, but I think they encompassed other aspects of the gap or the bridge that needed to be formed in order to restore certain rights, autonomy that the states wanted. As an example, stamp duty that was mentioned earlier on imposed on transfer instruments is something that was part of these 21 issues. Oil royalty was also one of these issues. The Territorial Sea Act, which I'll come to later. State rights under the continental shelf in Sabah, gas distribution and electricity regulation. State power on health, tourism and environment were also covered. And on that note, it's something which I think we should look at the wider impact of something being on the federal list, such as tourism, is that if one looks at the notion of decentralization, clearly those local governments or those state governments who are directly affected by tourism would be in a better position to legislate for, regulate and manage the tourism industry from their own shores rather than having to wait for Parliament to pass legislation for such matters. And I understand that there was a tacit agreement that tourism would be placed in the concurrent list as opposed to now in the federal list, so that the state could pass legislation on tourism, for which I know for Sabah is heavily reliant on for its economic ability moving forward. Out of these 21 issues, 17 were recorded as having been resolved, with an outstanding 4 that had not. And those outstanding 4 were the stamp duties on the transfer instruments that we mentioned earlier, oil minerals and oil fields, Territorial Seas Act, and the state rights on the continental shelf. Perhaps it would help if I elaborate a little bit on what we mean by the Territorial Seas Act. And this relates to state boundaries. Now, in 1954, there was North Borneo Order in Council, which stated that the boundaries of the colony of North Borneo included the continental shelf. Now, the continental shelf far exceeds 3 nautical miles, and pre-Malaysia, the boundary and territorial waters of Sabah were clearly much further than what is being prescribed now. Article 1.3 of the Federal Constitution states that the boundaries of each state are the territories immediately before Malaysia Day. However, in 1966, the Continental Shelf Act was passed together with the Petroleum Mining Act, and these were passed during the time of a declaration of emergency was in force, which empowers Parliament to make laws under Article 150, which shall not be invalid on the ground of inconsistency with any other provision in the Federal Constitution. In essence, this allows Parliament to pass laws which may be unconstitutional, and in doing so, the territorial waters of the state were limited to only 3 nautical miles. Now, this declaration of emergency was revoked on the 21st of November 2011, and thereafter, these two acts that were made during emergency ceased to be valid 6 months later. So what this means is the acts then limiting the territorial waters to 3 miles would no longer be valid. But shortly after, in 2012, the Territorial Sea Act was passed,
yes,
which
yes.
limits the territorial sea in Sabah to 3 nautical miles. And that's the sovereignty on the seabed and subsoil in the Yang di Pertuan Agong. The Agong acts upon advice of the federal cabinet. So essentially, this essentially hands over areas which are well within the boundaries of the state to the jurisdiction of the federal cabinet. Since this act essentially changed the boundaries of Sabah, it should have the consent of the state and the conference of rulers, and this is provided for in Article 2. Mm-hmm. There is no evidence of this having been obtained. Coupled with this is that the Sabah Land Ordinance states that all coal, mineral oils are reserved to the state government, and it also states that the Minister for Natural Resources can grant licenses and leases to mine and extract such mineral oils. It is certainly arguable that based on this reasoning, the state does not recognize the passing of the Territorial Sea Act 2012, and as a result, should be able to make it a prerequisite for licenses to be granted for any extraction of oil products from the state, which may be on the continental shelf. These are issues which clearly would have large impacts on the revenue for the state. And currently, as demonstrated recently, there was a court case between the Sarawak state government and Petronas in relation to the imposition of sales tax on oil products, which could have been derived outside the 3 nautical miles. I understand that case has been resolved amicably and that the Petronas have agreed to make payment of the sales tax on these oil products. This is an indication, I think, of the states, Borneo states, asserting their rights under the federal constitution, asserting their rights that were agreed pre-Malaysia, and asserting these rights to generate more revenue to redress the imbalance or the poverty imbalance between the Borneo states and West Malaysia. So I see this as a dynamic area for the states to act on. I see this as a good indication that the states maybe do not need to be politically beholden anymore in these issues which may be sensitive in the past. And this will only bode well for the future, because one draws a parallel, and I'm not suggesting this that this is the only way forward, but in the Federation like the United States of America, it's interesting to note that the states there have a lot of autonomy over seeking redress in the courts. It is a fact that the state of Washington had taken, I think, no less than 32 actions against the federal government, for instance, on issues regarding immigration executive orders that were passed by the federal government, and challenging them, saying that those interfere with the state's autonomy. And out of those 32, I think they have been successful in 15. I think that just shows maybe a more mature federation where one can seek redress in the courts without fearing that there may be political repercussions. And I'm not so sure whether this is an indication in the future that we may be seeing more of these being ventilated in our judiciaries.
I wonder, Brendan, if in lieu of a civil suit, we could rely on Article 130. to seek an advisory opinion of the federal court, though, of course, federal court then must sit with the whole bench, the kind of tradition that Tan Sri Richard Malanjan had initiated, whereby all of them will sit. Once earlier, I know that Tun Saleh had tried to do that all the judges will sit to hear the case. But that would be good. Instead of the blunt instrument of a litigation, we could get an advisory opinion on some of these issues.
Absolutely. That would be definitely a more or less controversial, confrontational approach. And I think that's where that provision exists in the federal constitution. There's no reason why we shouldn't seriously consider that being exercised and utilized, because having a third branch of government, the judiciary, give their legal opinion on this would go a long way to assisting the state and the federal government from resolving their differences.
Okay, all right. I'm afraid we're running out of time, but, you know, if there's any last message that, you know, both of you would like to leave our listeners with regard to the Malaysia Agreement 1963. I mean, how can we foster unity, I suppose, through an understanding of this agreement?
Well, obviously there are no simple solutions, but I think this ongoing dialogue must continue. We need to revive the spirit of accommodation, moderation, compromise that animated leaders of Malaysia in 1963. We need to accept, especially West Malaysian leaders need to accept, that unity does not mean uniformity. In fact, West Malaysian leaders must learn from Sabah Sarawak how they live a life which has much greater intercultural, interreligious, interracial harmony. On the side of Sabah Sarawak leaders, I think they should distance themselves from secessionist demands. My humble opinion is that the right to secession is not part of the constitution. It's not part of international law. It's not part of the 20-point agreement. In fact, in the 20-point agreement, there's a specific item says there's no right to secede. So I think we need to meet halfway so that this union, this federation, can become stronger, more united and more prosperous. Thank you.
Brendan, anything you'd like to add?
Yep, absolutely. I think we just need to keep these issues in the public eye. And these issues naturally appear in the media anyway. And probably a recent example of that would be Viviona Mosibin, the 18-year-old student who was on a tree trying to get internet access to prepare for her examinations. And it has been reported that 52% of the students in Sabah do lack access to internet and computers. And especially during this time when online learning is key during a COVID-19 pandemic. The other issue that brought these imbalances or this lack of consultation to light would have been during the movement control order, where we saw that there was a relaxing of that movement control order by the federal government, which saw the states not necessarily agreeing with the manner in which it was being relaxed. And that then brought into light the need, I think, for consultation between the federal government and the states, whereby certain powers reside with the federal government. In fact, Sabah has its own public health ordinance, which recognizes the director general as being a relevant authority in our local ordinance. That clearly envisages that there must be consultation between both federal and state in relation to avoiding one-size-fits-all sort of approach and trying to look at the various needs on the ground and what is best suited for the different environments that we live in. Clearly, if we recognize, I think, that these issues are very current, they exist, and that they need to be addressed, and only then can we sort of hope to realize the hopes and the aspirations of the people of Sabah. If we do that, that would go a long way to fulfilling the democratic ideals, the maintenance of unity, and the recognition of state rights and autonomy. Essentially, it is the intergovernmental relationship that needs to be strengthened. And, you know, politics aside, these issues are very much dealt with, I think, in a better, in a mature environment whereby we don't let politics affect what is necessary to redress the imbalance that we currently have.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, both of you, for joining me today. I've been speaking to Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Shad Salim Farooqi, who is a Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Malaya, and Brendan Keith So, who is the Attorney General of Sabah. And we were going through, what's been implemented, what's not been implemented for the Malaysia Agreement 1963, and also how we can move forward, to foster unity through a better understanding of this agreement. If you missed any part of this interview or any previous Law and Behold interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.